presentation. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. But the, aren't the, when they're at the podium, they don't need the mic, right?
But you know
if
what?
If they have, a lot of room.
Is there a table mic or a computer mic?
Q&A.
Well, we can just pass them to the person next to us.
Yeah. So, Dr. Ko, and then Bob. So we thank all of you for coming. If you would indulge us for a second for a photographic moment, and then we'll get started. While the introductions and photographs are being taken, it's our understanding that originally there was another session planned in this room. So if you are looking for sacredness of place, then you'll need to go to the stone room on the main level. I don't know what happened to, wait. Trying to get to the beginning. There we go. All right, so welcome to the session entitled Graduation is a Public Health Priority, Unpacking the Dimensions. You can't hear me? Their light's on. Can you hear me now? Hello? Can you hear me in the back? Yes? Sacredness of place is in the stone room on the main level. All right, so welcome once again to the session entitled Graduation is a Public Health Priority, Unpacking the Dimensions of Dropout. Also, you should note that as today is a lot of our theoretical underpinning for this type of work, there will be a session tomorrow, session 4083, called Beyond the Clinic 2, using school-based healthcare for primary public health prevention, and that will show you how this model will work in practice, as well as some folders in the back for the Center of School Health and Education. So my name is Janita Richardson. I'm an associate professor at the University of Virginia and am pleased to moderate this session for you today. I could spend all of the time we have allotted sharing with you the many contributions of the members of our panel today, but we really want to make sure that we have time for them to help us understand the links between high school graduation rates and health. Each of our speakers will have 15 minutes, after which we'll have about 15 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes for Q&A, at which time I'll come back up to the podium. The order in which our presenters will speak are as follows. Dr. Howard Koh, who is the Assistant Secretary for Health in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. He serves as the 14th Assistant Secretary for Health and Human Services and oversees 12 offices, which include the Office of the Surgeon General, the Commissioned Corps of the U.S. Public Health Services, and his work requires an adept capacity to understand the nexus between the many social determinants that impact health. Followed then by Dr. Robert Balfance, who is going to talk to us about the deconstruction of dropout. He is a senior research scientist at Johns Hopkins University School of Education, where he's also the co-director of talent development secondary and the co-director of Everyone Graduates Center. And his research focuses on secondary school reform and the links of chronic absenteeism to graduation rates. We'll be then followed by Dr. Charles Bash, whose affiliation is as the Richard March Ho Professor of Health Education at the Teachers College at Columbia University, and his research seeks to evaluate and understand health-related decision-making, influencing the links between health and educational readiness. We have someone who has graciously stepped in for Dr. Tolson, who has recently been appointed the Deputy Director for the White House Initiative on Historically Black Colleges and Universities. That'll be Dr. Ron Walker, who's illustrious in his own right. He is one of the founding members of the Coalition of Schools Educating Boys of Color, as well as its executive director. He will be followed then by Nick Freudenberg, who is a distinguished professor of public health and social and personality psychology at Hunter College at the City University of New York, and really began a lot of our understanding about the links between dropouts and public health in his seminal article. We now refer to it as the seminal article, Reframing High School Dropout as a Public Health Issue. Would you join me in welcoming all of our panelists? And now, in particular, Assistant Secretary Dr. Koh.
Thank you very much, Professor Richardson, and welcome everyone. It's great to see you all at this critically important meeting, and I want to thank you for being public health leaders ready to embrace the social determinants of health as a leading theme for public health in the 21st century. First of all, I want to remind you that you are in my home city of Boston, so go Red Sox. If they can do it, we can do it, right? I'm representing my 80,000 colleagues at the Department of Health and Human Services, our Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. Here I have some of my colleagues from our Office of Adolescent Health, Dr. Wilma Robinson and colleagues, from our Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion. I don't know if Carter Blakey and her colleagues are here. And then Kirby Bumpus, our policy advisor in the Office of the Assistant Secretary. So we're delighted to be partners with all of you. I am very, very grateful to my colleagues on this panel, Dr. Balfance, Dr. Bash, Dr. Freudenberg, and Dr. Walker. They are pioneers who have led the way helping us think about social determinants. And I'm absolutely pleased to be the kickoff commenter on this very important title, Graduation as a Public Health Priority, Unpacking the Social Dimensions of Success. Now, we're in a really critical time for tackling public health and communicating public health with respect to social determinants, because for too long we've thought of health as just as something that happens to you in a doctor's office. Now, I can say that because I'm a doctor, taking care of patients for over 30 years, but I was a young physician who quickly realized a long time ago that good health is much more than what happens to you in a doctor's office. In fact, we'd like to now say that health starts where people live, labor, learn, play, and pray. That's what the social determinants are all about. I made that up, so I'll say it again. Health starts where people live, labor, learn, play, and pray. Now, I've been the assistant secretary for some 4.5 years now, which I can't believe. But one thing I've learned every day in this job is that health is advanced when we health professionals are working closely with other people in other sectors of society. Any partnership you can build with other leaders throughout society where people live, labor, learn, play, and pray can advance public health. That's what the social determinants are all about. So increasingly, I'm in health meetings as part of the Obama administration where we have colleagues from Housing and Urban Development, from the Environmental Protection Agency, from Department of Energy, Department of Agriculture, and relevant to this session, the Education Department. And it's those collaborations that really are going to drive public health success for the 21st century and beyond. So we in public health have understood this social determinants theme for a while, but we really haven't been as serious about it as we should be. And one way we decided to show our commitment to the social determinants in general and to education in particular was to insert it into our national goals for the country in the healthy people process. Hopefully everybody here knows that healthy people is a roadmap and compass for our country with respect to health goals and objectives. We've had Healthy People 1990, Healthy People 2000, 2010. Every decade, we set goals and objectives for health outcomes and then track them and report back to the American people. As the Assistant Secretary, I had the great honor of unveiling Healthy People 2020 and putting forward goals and objectives for the country on behalf of Healthy People colleagues. And if we have indeed a 2020 vision for Healthy People 2020, we have to be serious about the social determinants, particularly including tracking education outcomes. For Healthy People 2020, as in previous years, we have about a dozen so-called leading health indicators. And one of them, for the first time ever, is dedicated to high school graduation rates. In fact, the indicator reads that we want to increase the proportion of students who graduate with a regular diploma 4 years after starting ninth grade, track that outcome over time as part of our health report card, and also demonstrate at the same time that we're serious about incorporating social determinants into our planning and goal-setting process for the future. There's a lot of evidence to support that this is the right thing to do. Studies by my colleagues here and others have demonstrated that education is a very strong, some say the strongest predictor of long-term physical health in adulthood, even after accounting for ethnicity or socioeconomic status. For example, those who are educated are more likely to be physically active, receive regular health screenings, are less likely to smoke. And education is also a strong predictor of mental health and overall well-being as well. In fact, this year, the Journal of Adolescent Health published a review of 25 years of evidence about the relationship between adolescent health behaviors and academic achievement. And not surprisingly, academic performance tends to suffer among those who are young people who use tobacco, alcohol, and other drugs, who experience or perpetrate violence, who engage in risky sexual behaviors, who have limited physical activity or inadequate nutrition. Now, we could debate about what comes first, the suboptimal academic performance or the risky behaviors. We'll probably need more research to tease that out, but for now, we need to tackle both themes at the same time, knowing that they are tightly related. In short, we need for our kids a chance for them to learn to be healthy and for them to be healthy to learn. That's why our Office of the Assistant Secretary has an Office of Adolescent Health that was established several years ago by Congress that has focused primarily on teen pregnancy prevention for right now, but is eager to expand into areas like this as a direction for the future. We also understand that chronic diseases can impede student performance. Asthma can be worsened in a suboptimal school environment. We know that schools should offer opportunities for physical activity if this is done right. We know that kids are wrestling with conditions like diabetes that need the services of a school nurse or other types of health services. And then we are having this discussion, of course, in the midst of health reform, the Affordable Care Act, passed into law in March of 2010, which is not just about insurance access, it's also about building a system of care and prevention for the future. One aspect of health reform that is very relevant to our topic today has to do with supporting a safety net, and in particular, supporting school-based health centers. School-based health centers are a major component of the safety net. Not only do they enable kids with acute or chronic illnesses to attend school, but they improve health and wellness of the student populations through health promotion and disease prevention. You may know that between 2010 and 2013, the Affordable Care Act provided some $200 million in funding to address the significant and pressing capital needs to deliver and expand services at school-based health centers. And through this funding, over 500 organizations, in fact, received the dollars necessary to provide services to about 875,000 school kids. So keeping kids and adolescents healthy, keeping them in school, providing these services in a school setting is critically important to advancing our Healthy People 2020 goal of increasing those high school graduation rates for kids around the country. Now, another theme I want to touch on as part of this very important conversation today is, why do kids drop out at all? What are the drivers of that, and what can we do about it? My colleagues here and many others have done research to show that, for example, one half of all female dropouts and one third of all male dropouts say that becoming a parent played a role in their decisions to leave school. Some of this research has been funded through the National Women's Law Center. So that's clearly a population in special need. So that's why, again, through the Affordable Care Act, our Office of Adolescent Health has received funding through a so-called Pregnancy Assistance Fund, and this provides a network of services to expectant and parenting teens, women, and families. Let me make this very concrete for you to explain how this works. One of the awardees is the so-called New Heights program in Washington, D.C. This is an incentive-based program that rewards students for school attendance, supports them as they participate in health education activities and other programs focused on health. Students who stay in school earn free items for their children, such as clothing and toys, and they also get access to programs to develop their financial literacy and relationship skills. And very concretely, the New Heights program placed a dedicated coordinator in each of 14 public high schools to connect with pregnant and parenting teens, both male and female, with these supports and these services in order to first keep them healthy, but also keep them in school and preventing them from dropping out. And so this program has been shown to be successful in reducing the number of repeat teen pregnancies in schools where it was implemented. And we're very excited about this particular model being one that we can perhaps keep going and expand and strengthen over time as we talk more about this very important link between education and health. So as I close and turn this over to my colleagues and engage in conversation with you, I want to thank you for embracing the social determinants as perhaps the critical public health theme for the future. And I think it's important for us not only to recognize this connection, study it, but also teach each other how to communicate this theme to not just public health audiences, but all audiences across society. There was one colleague of mine from Iowa who said at a conference once, she was referring to the social determinants, I think, but she said, quote, "It's not about the goldfish, it's about the water." I thought that was an interesting way to put it. And I think for all of us, as we communicate the social determinants theme, we can say, of course, health care is important to public health, but housing is important to public health, transportation is important to public health, education is important to public health. In fact, education is a major driver of public health. That's what this session is all about. In fact, we are here and doing this work in public health because fundamentally, at the end of the day, everything is interconnected, it's all interrelated, and we all have promises to keep. That's what it's all about. So thank you very much for having me this morning.
Good morning. So I'm here to deconstruct dropouts in 15 minutes or less. And the good news is I have no conflicts. Let's begin with the consequences. There simply is no work in the 21st century if you don't have a high school diploma, and certainly no work to support a family. That leads to a host of other issues. More dropouts are out of the labor force than full-time employed, more incarcerated, big health consequences we heard about, and there's intergenerational effects. And whole communities are cut off from the 21st century. How big is this problem? Well, there's 4 million kids in each ninth grade class, and of those, 3 million and change get diplomas. So that says about 78% graduate, which means about 800,000 kids, a cohort, are not prepared for the future, don't really have a chance. This is average. But for many subgroups, it's worse. So there are states where African-American graduation rate is below 60%. Look at Florida. Look at Ohio. Look at New York. This is where major parts of the African-American population live. Students with disabilities, it's even worse. There's some states where only half those kids get diplomas. The good news is we know why students drop out. We know which schools they drop out from. We know what the warning signs are. And we can do something about it. Some kids drop out because of life events. Stuff happens. Get pregnant, get arrested, have to work. Some kids drop out because they stop seeing the point. They think the jobs they'll get are the same whether they graduate or not. Some kids are pushed out. They're a problem for the school. They reach the legal dropout age. Assistant principal uses paperwork against them. When they miss a certain amount of days, they're gone. But most kids that drop out are just not succeeding in schools, and the schools are not succeeding in helping them. If we just had those first three categories, we'd have a problem. It's the fourth category that makes it a crisis. We know where these schools are located. There's about 1,400 schools that produce almost half the nation's dropouts. There's another 3,000 schools that produce the next 45%. That means a third of our schools produce 85% of the dropouts. And that's part of the problem, right? Because in many of the neighborhoods some of us live in, nobody drops out. The big challenge is, where is your kid going to college? So that's why it's a national crisis, but not a national issue. Because it's really localized in a subset of communities that are sort of the most disadvantaged and the most cut off communities. Oops. We know in these schools that dropping out is almost mechanical. Kids come to ninth grade, they miss a lot of school, they fail their classes. Because they fail their classes, they're not promoted to the next grade. They're told, try again under the same circumstances. They try, maybe with a little less effort, same outcome happens. They may have a short stint at an alternative school, and then they drop out. In these ninth grades, though, the problem clearly begins before the ninth grade. Because when we examine who's in these ninth grades, we see it's filled with kids that essentially missed having a good middle grades education, and often learn in the middle grades that education as it's organized and the experience is not for them. Let's look at some data. Each bar in this graph is a high school in Philadelphia. The first set, the low ones, are neighborhood non-selective high poverty high schools. The second set are selective magnet schools where you have to have admissions criteria, basically good grades, good attendance, good behavior to get in. What this graph shows is that 4 out of 5, and in some cases 9 out of 10 kids in these neighborhood high schools are not the kids the school was designed to educate. They're not on age. They're not there for the first time. They're not on grade level. And they didn't have good attendance in the middle grades. Most of the kids either have skills below the seventh grade level, had large absenteeism in the middle grades, are overage, or repeating the grade. So the challenge is immense. We know where these schools are located. About half are in our nation's cities. The other half are found throughout the South and Southwest in rural, low-wealth counties, small towns, and urban fringe. Every state has one. And imagine this, 25% of these schools are the only high school in town. Think what that says about the land of opportunity. If the only high school in your town is one where graduation is not the norm, in an era when there is no work if you don't graduate, how is that opportunity? So we can put them on a map. We can even see how their concentration and spread vary by states and do typologies to have different strategies. We also know that students are signaling early and often that they're off track to graduation. As early as sixth grade in many high poverty areas, we can identify half the kids who absent intervention won't graduate. We did this data first in Philadelphia, but replicated it in multiple cities and states now. And overwhelmingly, ironically, it's the ABCs of dropout prevention. You have to attend, you have to behave, and you have to pass your courses. It's pretty simple. And kids that are struggling to attend, struggling to stay out of trouble, and struggling to pass their courses fall off track, and absent intervention don't graduate. So basically this says that only one out of five of these kids in sixth grade in Philadelphia graduated. Imagine if you're 11 years old, and if we don't do anything, your life is greatly circumscribed, right? Chronic absenteeism. I think this is a really important thing for the public health field because it's an area where I think you can measure it daily, weekly. You know if you're making a difference right away. If you're trying to move literacy scores, it's hard to figure out what worked, what contributed, and there's such a time lag in getting the data back. But absenteeism, you do something, the kids come to school, you know you're having an impact. We have no idea how bad the chronic absenteeism problem is in our high poverty areas. In the most impacted schools, it's routine for 30, 40, 50% of the kids to be missing a month or more of school. That's hundreds of kids. That means a teacher has a different group of kids in her classroom every day. One reason we don't know about this is we don't measure it. Only a handful of states actually measure regular attendance. Everyone measures average daily attendance. How many kids are in the building that day? But those of us that, you know, play with statistics know that you can actually have a 90% ADA rate, average daily attendance, and have a fifth of your kids missing a month or more of school. Because it's different kids on different days making that 90%. So it's a case where an A is not good, but we're hardwired to say 90% must be good. When you look at this over time, it's truly astounding. We followed a cohort of sixth graders in a city forward over 5 years, and we found that 25% of these kids missed a year of school between the sixth and 10th grade. We did this in a state, and we found in a state, we found 20,000 kids in a cohort who missed half a year of schooling between sixth and ninth grade. And when we followed these kids through to university, we found that only 3% of them enrolled in the state university system. So again, these kids' essentially school career is over by the middle grades, early high school, because they have barely had a school career, given how many days they missed. Not surprisingly, the cost of inaction is high. School disengagement precedes involvement with juvenile justice and teenage pregnancy. So in Philadelphia, we crossed school data with social service data, and we found that 2/3 of the males incarcerated in high school had a sixth grade off-track indicator, and 2/3 of the females who became pregnant had a sixth grade off-track indicator. And my theory here is we only have so much resilience. We actually have a lot, but it's 3 or 4 years of resilience. So if you're struggling from sixth grade forward to ninth grade, by ninth grade you're going in another direction. But the good news is solutions exist and progress is possible. The nation's graduation rate is actually going up. It's gone up from 72 to 78% over the past decade after 30 years of stagnation. In the last decade, about a quarter of the states and a quarter of our biggest districts have shown real progress. And the number of these low graduation rate high schools, because I had to give you some good stuff here, right? We had a lot of sad stuff, right? Are actually going down from about 2,000 to about 1,400, as there's been a big push to have high school reform and alternatives and greater supports. But we really have to keep it going because we still have 1,400 of these schools producing 40% of our dropouts. So what works? Well, take the public health pyramid and curve it a little bit. So basically, you have to have whole school reform, then you have to have a next set of supports for kids at the scale needed. And this is the hard part for schools. In this middle bucket of extra supports, it's hundreds of kids who need these extra supports in a school. Schools are designed only to give extra supports to tens of kids. And that's the crux of the problem, the crux of the solution we have to find. And then, of course, for the kids that need, that doesn't work, we go to the higher need supports. We found when you do this idea of whole school reform, enhanced student supports, guided by an early warning system, you can really drive these numbers down. So these are some early results from a randomized field trial that we're doing in 60 high schools across the nation and middle schools. And essentially, you can drive these numbers down by about half when you basically reorganize the school, when you have weekly tracking and early warning indicator meetings that include teams of teachers working with a common set of students, supported by enhanced National Service Corps members and other student support providers, and you mobilize in sort of that tiered strategy, you can, you know, as much as half drive these numbers down. So with that good news, I will leave you to our next talk.